This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello and welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. I'm Alan Saunders, and most of this week's show is about the doctrine of equality. But first, here's a French teacher of philosophy.
Pour que tu saches, mec, que le mot philosophie, il vient tout droit du grec. Philos, ami, Sophia, sagesse, je te raconte pas d'histoire.
Et Sophia aussi,
c'est aussi le savoir. C'est environ 7 siècles avant le fameux JC, qu'on mit encore un grec préféré à la rationalité. Son nom était Thalès, son école Milet. Dès lors, il n'eut de cesse d'imiter la méthode des maths pour penser.
Thierry Aimet in the classroom with the rap Qu'est-ce que la philosophie? What is philosophy? So what's going on here? Well, if you check out the film clip that goes with the rap, you can find it on YouTube, links on our website, you'll see Monsieur Aimet in a classroom, and you can spot pictures of René Descartes and of Immanuel Kant on the back wall. The students are presumably among the 620,000 pupils in France who last week sat the compulsory 4-hour baccalaureate exam in philosophy. And Monsieur Aimet thinks that you can get the doctrines of Europe's great philosophers into the consciousness of the young with lyrics like these. Our mind makes the selection, well then it's in the subconscious where these thoughts lurk and wait. Against Descartes, you can say the subconscious has its part to play. Well, be fair, he's presumably not responsible for the translation. And in any case, not everybody agrees with him. Joey Starr, the lead singer of a popular French rap group, commented that philosophy is the antithesis of sexy. That's fighting talk around here, Monsieur Starr. But what sort of philosophical world are we talking about here? Well, a French one, a continental one, which means something very different to what goes on in most of the philosophy departments of the English-speaking world, and by the way, the Nordic countries too. To get a grip on this, let's listen to some more of the conversation we heard last week. At the Sydney Writers' Festival, I'm in conversation with Simon Critchley, Professor of Philosophy at the New School for Social Research in New York.
Let's begin with a slight bias towards continental, particularly German and French philosophers, rather than English language philosophers. In an interview some years ago, you said, when you realised that one of the things that you could study at university was philosophy, you began to read The Inevitable, Russell's Problems of Philosophy, Ayer's Central Questions of Philosophy. And if I'm honest, you say, I really didn't get an enormous amount out of them. For me, philosophy has to address the question of existential commitment and the fact that the person who is philosophizing is a flesh and blood human being. It also has to address historical, social, and political questions. It always seemed to me from very early on that what I learnt to call continental philosophy seemed to fit those concerns much better than Anglo-American philosophy. So can you just tell us about this? I mean, I was educated on the Anglo-American side of this division. So can you just tell us how this division appears to you and whether you think it's still hard and fast?
It is hard and fast. Firstly, it's a sort of boring professional issue. Philosophers divide into camps you can broadly call analytic and continental. In the English-speaking world, the analytic philosophers run the richest universities.
The oldest.
And the continental philosophers are consigned to the wasteland like Essex, where I used to teach, or places like Coventry, Warwick, or in the United States, the Catholic schools, the Catholic universities. So that's the professional side, and I could talk about that, but it's sort of boring. And there's a deeper story which I try and tell, which is more interesting, I think. In 1832 and 1840, John Stuart Mill, who's quite difficult to categorise in terms of this division, wrote two essays. 1832, an essay on Bentham, 1840, an essay on Coleridge. And he said of Bentham's thinking, it's dominated by one question. The question, is it true? Of any doctrine, you ask the question, is it true? Is it empirically verifiable, let's say? The Coleridgian asks the following question: what is the meaning of it? So what the Coleridgian is after is not the truth of something, but what a thing means, which means how we might give a context and how we might interpret a phenomenon. And Mill says this tendency that we can assign to the name Coleridge is the continental philosophy, or the Coleridgio-Germano-Franco doctrine, he calls it. And then he says a very interesting thing. He says, he who would seek to understand the English philosophical mind, if that's not a contradiction in terms, as Nietzsche would say, he who would seek to understand the English philosophical mind should understand these two tendencies. There's a basic antagonism between these two tendencies, between, as it were, an is it true tendency, can we empirically prove it, and a what is the meaning of it tendency. And I try and show that these two tendencies make up, constitute a culture, the culture of, say, Englishness. And you could translate this into different terms. You could translate it into Arnold's distinction between Hebraism and Hellenism. There are different ways of thinking it through. But there you've got a much richer story about these two traditions. And the thing is that Coleridgio continental philosophy doctrine, that stuff, in the 20th century disappears out of mainstream philosophy. It reappears, this is my hypothesis, as that thing that we call English literature in, say, the 20s. So if you're really interested in this question of these two traditions, it's really a distinction between forms of analysis, which make a nod towards philosophy of science, for the most part, logic, on the one hand, and, let's say, a more literary approach, distinction between science and literature. And so I try and interpret the distinction between analytic and continental philosophy in terms of the distinction between what C.P. Snow called in the famous lecture he gave at Cambridge in whenever that was, 1959, the two cultures.
Simon Critchley. On ABC Radio National, you're with the Philosopher's Zone. And now, the annual John Passmore Lecture was presented recently at the Australian National University by Larry S. Temkin, Professor 2 of Philosophy at Rutgers University in the US. His subject was one supposedly dear to Australian hearts, egalitarianism. But have we got it right? Larry Temkin.
The notion of egalitarianism is an extraordinarily powerful and loaded one. So many contemporary debates across the spectrum, whether we're talking about the relationships between blacks and whites, or aborigines and non-aborigines, or people in rich countries, poor countries, animals, non-animals, is often put in the rhetoric of equality. In the name of equality, we must do this for such and such a group. And oftentimes these arguments are shrouded in confusion, and many, many different notions and concerns are being blurred together and called the concern for equality. And I don't think this is a good way to argue. I don't think it's good politically. I mean, it has a certain rhetorical force. But as a philosopher, I would much prefer to see that people be very clear about what it is they actually do care about and what it is that underlies the various positions they're arguing for.
Well, let's look at some of the distinctions that you introduce into the discussion. One is between instrumental and non-instrumental egalitarianism. What's the difference here?
This is a very important distinction because, as indicated already, I think many, many people blur together different conceptions. Many people are instrumental egalitarians. An instrumental egalitarian is someone who cares about equality as a means or way of promoting some other ideal about which they care. So they might want a redistribution from the better to the worse off, which does in fact bring about equality. But the reason they might want to bring about that redistribution from better to worse off might have nothing to do with a concern for equality per se, but a concern about all sorts of other things that are of importance to them. So you can imagine if someone was very concerned about, for example, humanitarianism, and people were hungry and they wanted them to be fed, they'd say, well, see all these very wealthy people here? If we redistribute from the better to the worse off, we can help feed the hungry people. So in their concern about feeding the hungry people, they advocate an egalitarian reform. But that's not a concern for equality itself. That's a concern for equality as a means to promoting something else they care about. That's what I call instrumental egalitarianism. Non-instrumental egalitarianism is a view, it's a view that I hold, which says there's something valuable about equality itself over and above the extent to which it promotes certain other ideals that we care about.
How does the question become complicated or richer, let's say, if we bring in the issue of comparability? What's that?
I think equality is, at its root, a relation that obtains between different people. Some people are more or less equal relative to each other. So the concern that some people not be worse off than others, who are no more deserving than they. And this is a very important notion, I believe, and I think is deeply and intimately connected to a notion of comparative fairness that we have.
I mean, I suppose an example of how this might apply is if I compare Bill Gates with, say, Donald Trump. I assume that Bill Gates has got more money than Donald Trump, but it doesn't offend our sense of egalitarianism because compared to me, they're both very rich. It's just compared to each other that they're not.
All right, so this raises a deep and important question. So back up for 1 second. The kind of egalitarian I am is fundamentally concerned, I claimed, with comparative fairness. So as I said, if I can repeat for 1 second, they think it's unfair when some are better or worse off than others, no more deserving than they. Now, having said that, that kind of egalitarian can allow some people to be better off than others without offending your egalitarian intuitions. If, for example, you believe that they deserved it. So if one thought, for example, that Bill Gates, you know, was very hardworking and made this wonderful discovery, and as a result, he deserved his greater fortune relative to Donald Trump, then the kind of egalitarian I am doesn't object to that inequality because they don't think it involves comparative unfairness. If, on the other hand, one thought that Bill Gates and Donald Trump were equally deserving, neither was, you know, any more hardworking or any more deserving, morally or otherwise, than the other, then that inequality bothers this kind of egalitarian. It doesn't bother this kind of egalitarian, that is, the kind of egalitarian I am, as much as the inequality between, say, Bill Gates and you, or the inequality between Bill Gates and people in Chad, or Ethiopia, or elsewhere. But it's still unfair for Trump to be worse off than Gates if he's no less deserving than Gates. That's the thought.
Faced with instances like that, and even more dramatic instances of simple inequality of physical ability given at birth, like people who are born blind, some anti-egalitarians would say that there are a lot of instances in the world of inequality. Some of these are simply ineradicable. We can't get rid of them. We've got to live with them. And egalitarians are essentially promoting or advocating a form of philosophical envy.
Right. This is a common charge. I think one has to make a number of different distinctions here. It certainly might be the case that there's nothing one could do about certain inequalities. I think that's rarely actually the case, but nonetheless, it might be the case. That would show that there was nothing bad about the situation or nothing wrong about the situation. Suppose that we're all about to be lined up and executed, and you know, some evil dictator takes us out into the forest, lines us against the wall, he's about to shoot us all, and there's nothing that could be done about it. That wouldn't show that there wasn't anything wrong about it or anything bad about it. Of course there's something wrong about it, something deeply bad about it, and we ought to stop it if we can. What it shows us is that there might be reason to do something about that situation if we could, though in fact we can't. Now suppose some people are in fact born blind, and suppose that in fact there is nothing we can do about it. That doesn't show that there isn't any unfairness or anything wrong or anything bad about it. It shows that there is something bad about the situation, and it tells us that we do have some reason, some moral reason, the moral reason of comparative fairness, to help such people if we can. And among other things, that might give us some political dictate to pursue certain lines of medical research, for example, because there's egalitarian reason to pursue that research to, for example, cure blindness.
There's an example that you offer to illustrate the issue of fairness. Let's say you give one piece of candy to Andrea and two to Rebecca, and Andrea thinks this is unfair. Well, it's certainly unequal, but is it unfair given that neither of them had any right to expect candy at all? And is it more unfair than if you were to keep all the candy to yourself?
The question, is it more unfair if I were to keep all the candy to myself? This sort of depends on many different factors. I should emphasize this. All sensible egalitarians, I like to think I'm one of them, they're all pluralists. We all recognize that there are many, many, many things that matter morally. One of the constant criticisms of egalitarianism takes the form of showing that if all you cared about was absolute equality, it would have these terrible, disastrous consequences. But typically, all that shows is that equality is not the only thing that matters. It matters, but it's not all that matters. The thing is, the same is true of every other significant moral ideal. Kant famously said, "Let justice be done though the heavens should fall." And Kant actually believed that. Kant thought that if you had imprisoned an innocent man for even 5 minutes, to save a million lives, it would be wrong to do that. Now, virtually every one of us agrees that Kant is mistaken about that. It wouldn't be wrong to falsely imprison an innocent man for 5 minutes if that were necessary to save a million lives. But that doesn't show that there isn't anything important about justice. It merely shows that while justice matters, it's not all that matters. Now, part of what you're pointing to in your question touches on that issue. It may be that I don't have any personal obligation to give my candy to either of them. I could give both pieces to Andrea, no pieces to Andrea, one piece to each. Maybe it's my candy. Perhaps I have the right to do with it what I want. Nevertheless, the claim is that if, in fact, Andrea and Becky are both equally deserving individuals, and if I give two pieces to Becky and one piece to Andrea, Andrea can plausibly charge that that's unfair because she's worse off than another, no more deserving than she. Now, of course, that's a very trivial kind of thing, case of candy. It's not unfairness in the manner that really matter to us greatly, the unfairness of the major issues of quality of life. It's just a simple example. But not all unfairness, and this is very important, not all unfairness is equally bad. Some unfairness is terrible, and some unfairness is indeed quite trivial.
I'm interested in your characterization of unfairness. Does it make sense to talk about unfairness unless there is some agency involved that intends the unfairness? The fact that some people are born blind is an inequality in the world, but there is no agency intending that some people should be born blind and others sighted. Therefore, I would have said it wasn't unfair. It was a terrible state of affairs, but not an unfair one.
Alan, this is an excellent question, and many people divide about this issue. You're in good company here. I mean, the Nobel laureate economist Amartya Sen once told me something very much like that. I'd written a book on inequality, and he said, "You know, Larry, I really like what you have to say, blah, blah, blah. But the truth of the matter is, I wouldn't say it's unfair. I might say it's unfortunate, it's too bad, blah, blah, blah. It's a bad state of affairs. But I want to reserve the notion of unfairness for when a particular agent is responsible for that." So that's what you say. And he says that, and various other people say that. I don't want to dictate here terminology. I mean, people can use words more or less as they like, as long as they're being clear and careful about what they mean when they use those words. I think there is a very powerful natural conception of what we call natural or cosmic unfairness. People resonate with that all that time. If someone sees, you know, this really evil person who's gotten away with enormous amounts of evil their whole life and flourish, and then they're in a terrible accident. And it's just an accident. People look and they smile to themselves and they say, "Cosmic justice." You know, it was cosmic justice. He got what he deserved. And that's a very common, powerful notion, the notion of cosmic justice, cosmic fairness, natural injustice. Many, many people do say, look, it's naturally unfair that some are born blind and others are not. Now, as I want to emphasize, to me, it's not the words that matter. It doesn't matter whether we call it unfair. What's important is that we recognize that the situation is bad. And it's bad in a way that, to me, says we have reason to do something about the situation if we can.
This is an issue that arises in the context of your, I suppose we can call it a thought experiment. It's almost a fairy story about the magic berries. Tell us about the berries and what that story has to inform us.
We're trying to see whether or not people really do have certain egalitarian intuitions or not. There are many people out there, many philosophers, many economists, many regular people walking the street who say, well, as long as it's good for some people and not bad for anybody else, there's no respect in which it's bad. All right, so the thought experiment concerns the following. So I have a child. His name is Daniel. When Daniel was 3, he was deathly afraid of death. Came to me at the age of 3 and he said, Daddy, I don't want to die. I don't want to lie underground in a box forever. Now, when your kid comes to you and they're really worried about this, you try everything you can to console them. And I told them all sorts of things, all the consolations of philosophy. But understandably, my son was actually not the least bit consoled. One of the things I mentioned to him was that everybody dies. He quite rightly looked at me and said, Daddy, I don't care if everybody else dies. I don't want to die. And that seemed to me a perfectly fitting response for his concern. He didn't want to be dead. But the question is, why did I say, look, death is a part of life. Everybody dies. All living things die. The reason I said that is because it evokes a fundamental conception of fairness. We're all in the same boat together. But suppose that weren't the case. Suppose some few people had discovered some magic berries, and these berries granted them immortality. And they didn't deserve it, they didn't earn it, they didn't discover it, they didn't work for it, they were just lucky. They just stumbled across these berries, and when they ate them, it allowed them to live forever. Now, this might be good for them, and it might not actually be worse for any of us. But now what do I say to my son when he says, Daddy, I don't want to die. It isn't fair. Now, this seems to me a very powerful question, and it reflects a very powerful notion that there is some kind of deep cosmic injustice about this situation or unfairness. Now, I want to emphasize again here, as a pluralist, I'm not committed to the view that it would be worse, all things considered, if some people live forever while the rest of us didn't. But I do think there'd be something very unfair about that situation, which doesn't exist in the current world, where all of us are mortal and die.
Larry S. Temkin, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
It's been my pleasure, Alan. Thanks so much for your time and attention.
And thank you for your time and attention. And thank you to Kyla Slavin for production on the show and Amory de Bettencourt for technical production.
Perdre la philosophie, c'est être en route. Et si tu crois que t'as tout compris, tu fais banqueroute. Celui-là même a tout perdu qui croit avoir tout pigé. Il est foutu s'il n'a plus le souci de se rendre.
To close, a bit more of Thierry Aimé's philosophical rap. He, by the way, says that this is the sort of thing that Plato would do if he were alive today. I wonder. This is how Plato says the ideal republic should treat the poet. We will fall down and worship him as a sweet and holy and wonderful being, but we must also inform him that in our state such as he are not permitted to exist. The law will not allow them. And so, when we have anointed him with myrrh and set a garland upon his head, we shall send him away to another city. The Philosopher's Zone will, however, still be in town next week.
La philo, la philo, qu'est-ce que la philosophie? Where, where? Qu'est-ce que la philosophie?
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National. on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.